so nice he had to come back twice. Welcome back to the Darrell McClain Show, Olympian and fourth degree black belt, Todd Williams. So welcome back to the show, Professor Todd, a guy who loves jiu-jitsu. How you been since we last talked to you?
Fantastic. Staying healthy and on the mats pretty much every day.
Good. So the last time when we talked, we were trying to breach a topic about older people and how they get in jiu-jitsu. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
You know, I get that question all the time. You know, it's like even this week when a newer student comes in and they'll say, you know, I'm too old for this. I'm too old for this. I'm like, no, you're not too old for this. You just got to, you know, for the 21-year-old that comes in that's wrestled his whole life, that's a different type of athlete, right? For the 45 or 50-year-old that comes in, I'm like, we got to take baby steps. You know, we're going to start with break falls. We're going to start with the drills. And then you're gradually going to start to build into the technique and then situational training. And then hopefully you're off to the races with sparring. But I try to take my time with that older grappler so they don't get discouraged. Because I think, you know, some people come in and they want to do too much too soon. And then you don't see them after about a month in. There's no more jiu-jitsu student at that age. But I try to gradually bring them on and build confidence, kind of building steam for that older grappler. Because if not, they're going to get lost and get frustrated and not come back.
And do you also control, I guess, who they spar with and everything like that? Because,
you know, isn't that the toughest part? Because you probably came up the way I did, and it was like I sparred, I think, the first day. You know, I signed the waiver, and we did a couple, you know, a takedown, a scissor sweeped him out, and then he was like, okay, get a drink. And I was like, okay. And next thing you know, he's like, you go with that guy. I was like, oh, here. That's the way I did it. But I don't, to me, it was the right way to do it because I was still here and I love it. But for, I think, the majority, I think, you know, there's that time period where I like to say, okay, for a beginning student, I want them to know a couple takedowns. I want them to know the fundamental positions like close guard bottom, close guard top, side side, mount bottom, mount back, and then we'll do situational training, and I'll make sure they go with an upper belt, you know, upper blue, purple, brown, and so that person can work with them. Because the white belt that first starts, a majority of the white belts, as you know, man, they come at you like it's the, you know, the UFC championship, and I've had my tooth knocked out, I've had my ribs broke, I've had my ear ripped off, all by white belts.
Damn.
You know, so they're just, it's a rough roll. And, you know, and that's to be expected. So that's the reason you have to kind of put those guys with the upper belt. You know, because if you put two white belts together and they're that, it's like a tornado going off in the corner of the mat.
Yeah,
so you got to gradually bring those guys into the sparring.
Yeah, it's that, and then I don't know. We got a lot of new white belts that just came in, and they are all wrestlers. And I was actually talking to one of them last night, and I was just like, you know, I said, you have to transition your wrestling to jiu-jitsu, but I said, you also have to learn some other things because you're not going to always be this explosive. So I was telling them, you know, you have to gradually use these movements. So when we live sparred, you know, he was only 21, and I beat him, and I just said, well, you're a wrestler. I said, so I'm going to use my wrestling to stop you from wrestling, and I'm going to do jiu-jitsu, I know what you know, and I know what you don't know. And he's actually pretty strong. I think he's naturally going to be good. But
I think the biggest thing with the wrestlers, and it's hard to teach, right? When I first started, you know, the older belts would tell me, hey, man, you need to slow down. You know, you know, for you to last in this sport, you got to slow down. Yeah. But if you're a competitive person, you really don't know what that means. It takes time on the mat to realize, hey, it's okay to fall back into half guard. It's okay to get your guard passed, to get, you know, to mount and play this game. So, because you can go in there tonight and say, you know what, I don't have to tell my training partner, but I'm just going to relax on the bottom and just be calm the whole time. Yeah. He doesn't even have to know that you're playing a game. But look how long we've trained to get to that point where you know enough technique where you can do that. And that's where I think when, you know, you hear some of these YouTube guys or, you know, some of the jiu-jitsu school owners or some of the, you know, when they say jiu-jitsu is for everyone, I wish it was for everyone, but it's really not. It's you try to, you know, I try for my school, my academy, I try to make it so it's really inviting, but I'm honest with them. I say, you know, this, it's hard. Jiu-jitsu, yeah. It's rewarding. It's hard. I try to make it as easy and inviting as possible. But at the end of the day, it is a pretty grueling journey to go from the first day to the 10-year point. There's a lot of stuff that happens in that time period if you stick with it.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. I can say it's not for the weak-hearted, because you're going to have your days where your body's going to tell you you can't do things, and your brain you'll want to do it. So it's like you have to constantly evolve and transition to like I said, you know, that wrestler who starts playing bottom half or starts pulling guard, you know, because I think it, if you can get the ego out of it, it's kind of rewarding. It makes it always fun. It's always like, yeah. The second you think you know everything, that's when you're bored of practice and yawning. But if you're excited about learning something from every position, or how can you do this from that position, it's always fun. The other day, Dan was teaching like arm bars from a neon belly, the old school neon belly, and I was learning them. And then Taylor came through and showed a different way to do neon belly, and I was like, oh, I've never even seen it, you know, from that angle. And it was just like, I kept thinking, well, she's a featherweight and he's a heavyweight, and that's just, you know, so it was still something that's simple like that. I was just like learning minute details became fun. So when I was doing my rolls the other day, I was laying there and somebody went knee on belly, and I was able to get out of it just like that, got a takedown. And I said, oh, when I saw Dan doing it, I also saw him doing the counters. So,
yeah. And see, and I think that's, you know, the variations of all of us, right? So you can do an arm bar a little bit different. I do an arm bar, and that's what the beginner student, like, you know, I'll hear them sometimes say, well, my, you know, if I have a visitor, they'll say, well, my coach, it's this way to do it, right? I'm like, that's the way your coach does it. This is the way I do it. This is the way he's going to do it. This is the way you do it. But you'll find over time that how it fits your game. But then again, as you and I both know, you have to have success with the way you do it against an upper belt,
yeah,
for it to be validated. Because, you know, again, I think I mentioned this last podcast, when if a white belt hits an Americana inside the closed guard and he thinks, hey, this works. No, it worked against that other white belt because he didn't. But or a cross choke for inside the cross, you know, inside the closed guard. So there's certain things you have to continue to, you know, test out against, yeah, that upper blue, purple belt, and then you can. That's what I say. I only teach things that I know that I've hit, yeah, in hard live sparring against an intermediate player and, you know, an advanced. If not, it's, you're teaching something that's not real.
Yeah, I think too, in jiu-jitsu, they kind of have that. It's not like wrestling in the traditional sense where you kind of know what works. So it's really you fall into these categories where a lot of the professors are coaches, or just athletes who then opened up a school, and they're just trying to teach their fighters exactly how they fight. But it's like, well, there was probably reasons why you did that, and it was necessarily effective. And so I like the different variations, learning it from here, learning it from there, because then you say, well, that worked for the coach because for this many years he had a bad ankle, so he had to do it that way. Well, I don't, you know, and it's just, I don't think sometimes when athletes, especially grapplers, are doing certain positions, they know why they're doing it. They're just teaching it, you know, this is what my coach taught, this is this, and it's like, yeah. But then it's also, if there's anywhere you can make any adjustment in that chain, you'll throw the whole process off because they've been taught A, B, C, D, like, And so it's actually, it's interesting because, like, I've been working on arm triangles, and I was like, oh, now I see them everywhere. but I didn't used to, it wouldn't be anything I used to go for, but the second I started trying to do it, I see them all over the place.
Right. Yeah, and that's what, you know, it's, you know, we focus, let's say, for, well, platas or deep half or, you know, lapel guard, you know, even working on that. And then, you know, like for deep half, like I'm a half guard player, but I really never focused on deep half. Then when you start thinking all the ways you can get to deep half, I feel like it. I've seen the light on the deep half now over the last couple weeks. All I've been trying to do is hit deep half off of my half guard, and it's a game changer. It's like I could have been using these in the last three or four competitions because I, you know, I went back. I'm like, I could have hit it there. I could have hit it there. I could. And it's almost, if you look at Bernardo Faria, you know, and you watch him over the years at the highest level possible, you get into a deep half unless they control that knee on the top, which is really a kind of a stalling pattern. You're going to get the sweep. I mean, it's really difficult for them to stop the sweep unless they're going to stall to grab that top knee. Yeah. And, you know, here I am 21 years into my jiu-jitsu, and I'm like, there's another light bulb. It's like, gosh, I can keep learning. You know, and then I keep going back in. Like, if I did 35 rounds last week, all I was trying to do is deep half sweeps. I would get the sweep, then I go back down to try to get it again and get it again.
Is that what you do when you say your situational training?
No, that would be like, and just like today, you know, I sparred for an hour or so. I would have it in my head, like all I'm going to do when I do this is straight going for deep half, no matter where I'm at. Like, even if he mounts me, I'll turn on purpose. So he'll go to technical mount and then I'll double scoop that leg. If he doesn't get it tight enough up against his heel, up against my belt line or my, you know, right underneath my belly, which I always see when you go into technical mount, you need to be tight. Mm-hmm. If they give you a little bit of space, you can double scoop that leg. So both arms are underneath. And then once I fall back to my shoulder, then his leg is right there ready for the taking for the deep half. So I just pop that leg in there. And then I always try to connect the dots from any position from the bottom to try to go into those positions, you know, and that's how my brain works. It's like, I constantly try to fill every position that I can try to get into that, especially if I call it old man jiu-jitsu. If I can slow the game down and deep half is the way I can slow it down, I feel like I'm going to get those young guys tired, and then it's time for me to – I go back to the snapping turtle. If I can be that old snapping turtle just waiting, then I got a chance.
So do you when you have your classes, you teach your middle-age or upper-age fighters different techniques than your younger ones?
I'm fortunate, again, with school's not a big, big school, you know, like the Atos and all those big schools, but I do have some really good people in my school to teach, let's say, the 10th Planet with the rubber guards or the Baron Bolos, because I'm not doing that, you know, so I'm like, I'm not doing it. But if I have a kid that's a younger kid, it's explosive, athletic, really flexible, I'm fortunate that I have, say, hey, open mats, I want you to work with him on this position because I think it'd be awesome for you. So I try to really... You know, if I've got 85 people in my school this month, I try my best to end of it. Like, if you came to my school, I'd watch you, I'd study you, and I would try to help you and say, man, try this for your game, your body style, your type. And then if I have an upper belt that has that solid foundation in that particular technique, open mats are so important to me because that's where it's the laboratory. Mm-hmm. When I teach the class, it's old school fundamental pressure, you know, all the stuff that I've done over 20 years of jiu-jitsu, which is, it's pressure passing, it's control, it's not rushing to the submission, it's making the person get tired and frustrated, and then try to get to the next dominant position. Yeah, so I never teach fancy stuff.
It's difficult, I guess, because. Now they have the things that are pretty exciting, like fight to wins and WNOs. And it seems like people want to do the fancy footlocks because they think that's going to get them attention, you know, on the big stage. So they don't want to do the basic fundamentals. They, you know, we have a lot of people that'll come in and they'll just be trying to do these leg entries. And it's like, once they don't get that, you see them on the ground just flopping like a fish because they didn't learn, you know.
Right.
They don't know how to frame. They don't know how to get out of mount. They don't know how to get out of side. And so it's like, well, I don't know. Like, what is that going to do for you? You know?
Yeah. And, you know, and I get that question a lot with the younger students, you know, because now with YouTube and with BJJ Fanatics and, you know, Flow Grappling and all the information and resources we have to it's great on one hand, but then it's a negative on the other, because there, you as an instructor want to say, look, man, you have to understand the basic concepts first, and then let's go into this other stuff. I like heel hooks. I like toe holds. I like knee bars. I like, you know, I like all that stuff. But to me, for the majority of the students in the world that do jiu-jitsu, they're not going to be Gordon Ryan. And I hate to say it. They're not going to be Keenan Cornelius. They're not going to be JT Torres. They're not going to be Mikey Musumeci. They're not going to be Lucas Lepre. What they're going to be is a jiu-jitsu practitioner that needs fundamental jiu-jitsu to be pretty successful, right? In their gym, because most people don't even compete. So it's like, I want to give you some tools that I'm going to make you happy inside this gym. And then if you ever happen to get into a confrontation or a self-defense scenario, I'm trying to give you some tools that will give you a fighting chance, a better chance, right?
Yeah.
And so number one is having a great experience in the gym with fundamental jiu-jitsu. Then number two is having that good, positive self-defense side if you ever need it, which I hope they never need it. And then after that, I think that's when you can bring in the leg entries and, you know, the more advanced, I call that, you know, kind of that more advanced game. But if you don't have fundamentals, none of that other stuff's going to work.
I had another little technical question or coaching question. There's a debate that some people say it's better when you do jiu-jitsu to teach defense first, then offense, or then others say offense, then defense. So do you teach the more, like, what's your take on it? Do you teach a mix of the two, or are you more offense and then counters? So
I think, go ahead.
So, I mean, like, so for me, when I learned practice, I learned jiu-jitsu from trying to learn how to get out of things. And then once I got confident getting out of things, and I got comfortable trying stuff, that's kind of what I mean.
Yeah. Coming up through, you know, one of my first experiences with the highest level was in 2006 with Marcelo Garcia. I had him come down to Florida when I lived in Florida. I had him come to a seminar. We hung out for 2.5 days. I picked up, it was just him and I, and then we had the seminar. But, you know, Marcelo, you know, when I was a blue belt, his style was attack, 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 and keep attacking, right? Mm-hmm. Never, you know, I get that, but that's Marcelo Garcia. You know, I think for, you know, then you take Saulo Ribeiro, you know, you read their book, and you know, I spent some time training out in San Diego with Shanji and Saulo. And for their beginners, the most important thing is defense and learning how to survive. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like that, the meshing side of those together. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, the defense, a true defense, both on the self-defense side to protect yourself, and then on the jiu-jitsu side, to stay tight, not push, you know, the fundamental side of staying safe, that's going to open up your offense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the more your defense develops, the more chances you can take. Like Gordon Ryan would say, right? The better your defense is, the more chances you can take on your offense, because you know you can get out of the bad spot. But again, I think so if I had to answer the question, which one I would pick first, I think the defensive side is the most important side. And then you develop that, and then you can attack, attack, attack. Because, you know, you can survive if you do get caught in something, and you got a better chance to survive.
Yeah. All right. So, speaking of the defense and then attack thing, I think it was Hickson the other day that was saying that some of the stuff that he sees in sports jiu-jitsu, basically he's saying it's impractical. And it's more because they're doing things to get points for a certain sports system. But pretty much, if they did that anywhere outside, they would be harmed, like they'd be killed. What do you think about that? And how do you, for your students who do want to compete, how do you like tell them, hey, this is just for competition. Don't do this, you know,
In a street fight.
Yeah, yeah.
In a self defense situation.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing I tell my student is, hopefully you never get in a street fight. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want anybody, you know, I know I've got some young kids in my school that hopefully not, because I don't want that, but, you know, maybe they're looking just to show off their jiu-jitsu, because we all know people that just want to show off. I want to show them that it can work. Just like if I box for a long time, I might want to show them that, like, I got a good 1-2 overhand, right? You know, so it is what it is. So hopefully they never do get in that scenario. But back to Hickson's point, I do think if you just stop the camera, it's in some of the past, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, I'm thinking the development of, like, let's say the 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to see that in a street fight. But I think when you look at some of the high level who Hickson's talking about, those guys are I'm going to say a majority of those guys are so good, and ladies are so good to be able to get into those positions. They know the other positions too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't think you're going to see a Keenan Cornelius or a Meow brother pull a 50-50 if he got into a street fight. I think they're going to do a judo, drop, you know, a Tsunagi, or they're going to do an out.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It's so, like, I understand what Hickson's saying, because if you do tune in, it's getting, you know, some of the stuff now, they've moved away from the 50-50s and the slowdown games, yeah. You know, the advantage, sit up, 2 points here, 2 points there, attack a foot, you get the advantage, you win. But I'd also have to counter Hickson's point by saying most of these high-level guys and ladies, they know their stuff outside of just the point game.
Gotcha.
You know, like a Mikey Musumeci and, JT Torres just plays a pressure power. He doesn't really play any of the other, you know, he plays a wrestling slash hard driving game. But the guys that have played the different games and the ladies that I, you know, they're tough. They're tough. They're tough people. But for the beginner student, what I would tell those is back to the fundamentals, back to, you know, protecting yourself, your ready stance, knowing how to punch defense, knowing how to frame, you know, bear hug defense, tackle defense, you know, bear hug from behind, choke defense, really getting good at that self-defense slash jiu-jitsu, which I know some people hate the word self-defense jiu-jitsu, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like today I taught, you know, somebody comes up from behind, they try to pick you up on a bear hug, boom, how to control that lift so you don't get suplexed, or how you get taken out, you know, the kidnap game or whatever, you know, what I'll do with my kids. That to me is the most important thing. And the more you toughen yourself by that, getting grabbed by the neck or getting your collar ripped on or your cross-faced, and you become a tough person. You know, you may not be the baddest guy on the block, but if you do jiu-jitsu at a good school for a good, you know, good couple years, I think you should be able to handle yourself a lot better.
Yeah.
Than you did before you knocked on that door.
Yeah, then you're definitely you're battle tested. I was I was talking to one of the guys last night, and they kind of brought up the same conversation that me, you, and Taylor were having the other time. He went to a tournament. There was like four people. He placed second. And he was like, "Oh, the Melo does me thing." And I said, "I'm gonna tell you the same thing I told these guys." I said, "You can't help who shows up in the arena." I was like, "You showed up ready to test your metal and ready to fight." I said, "You can't help it if everybody else, you know, decided they didn't want to do it." So,
right.
And then like you were saying, I don't think that a lot of people know that a lot of people don't compete. So a lot of the times when you're testing your skills set, it's gonna happen in the room, you know.
Yeah.
And jiu-jitsu can be expensive. So a lot of people who do want to compete, just not, they can't afford it.
Well, yeah, and that's what I tried to do. You know, I think, you know, there's so many cool ways or creative ways that school owners, professors can help. You can do inter-squad scrimmages, right? You can do, you know, within your own team, say, hey, you're going to go with this person. Everybody circle up. Like sometimes I'll do that, man. And they're like, what? I'm like, everybody circle up. I'm not going to we're going to pick two names out of the hat.
Yeah, that's
and
nice.
And then what I do is I say, everybody in the circle, you guys start scoring. So you understand the scoring system. Mm. You guys see them, you know, and then maybe then I'll stop. We'll go into the next technique. And then I might stop again and say two more names are coming out. So that way they get the feeling and it's a free competition, but it ups the game. It ups the game because you're in front of your peers and there's a chance to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and it's a free opportunity. Then the next step from that is what I did last winter is I contacted one of my friends in Toledo. He has a school. And I said, hey, you want to do a dual meet for free? You know, so you send me your 20. I got my 20 and we match up and you come to my school. And we did they were on the left side of the gym. I was on the right. It was like a wrestling dual meet. And we did a dual meet and it was free. So, because you're right, there's a lot of people that barely can pay the $100 a month.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so let alone pay $100 a month competing if they, you know, it's tough on some people financially. So I try to understand that as a school owner and be creative so they can get that feeling of competing. Cause there's nothing better than competing. I mean, I think it helps your jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. Is that hard to juggle, you know, sometimes like the business owner side versus the, this student doesn't have enough money to continue, you know, side. I thought about that in a way that I didn't, because I listened to John Jock Machado's podcast, and he's talking about how he used to have all these people that used to come to his school for free virtually. So, and he just kind of didn't pay any attention to it. That was just, this is my buddy. So his wife recently took over the books, and she's like, what is all these people, you know? And he's like, oh, those are my friends. And so his wife says, well, we're going to see who really likes you from now on.
what I try to do, I've got good people, right? It's like, and jiu-jitsu's majority of, to me, are good people. Everyone I've met, my majority are really good people. But if I know, and Monroe's a small town, so I'm in the area where I kind of know what's going on. So if I know a student's having some tough times, I'll throw them a couple free months, or I'll throw them a free tournament. You know, I'll say, hey, and I won't even tell them it's for, you know, I'll just say, we got a private sponsor for you, you know, or I'll say, go give me the 100 for the month, and I might throw them back a 50 and say, hey, we got a private sponsor this month, here's a 50. You know, they won't even know. So I kind of get a feel, a pulse of what's going on, because you can tell when people are going through tough times, especially as a school owner, you're with them so much, you kind of get to know them really well, their job, what's going on. So I'll try to help. Now, what bothers me, though, is when somebody says they don't have any money and they're trying to ask for, you know, a free month or whatever. But yet, now this is when I was on social media. They try to tell me that they don't have any money, but then on Facebook, they're out partying until 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? Yeah. I don't know. You know, now that's when when a school owner starts being taken advantage of, when they're trying to be nice and trying to be helpful, and then that's when I got to have a talk and say, you know, and I'll just be straightforward. I'm like, it's $100.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I try. I don't have any hidden fees. I don't pay for belt testing. You don't have to have my patches, but it's $100 a month, unlimited training, no contracts. But if you want, and if I try to help you, don't take advantage of it and throw it in my face.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, I've seen it to where you'll see some people, they'll be very promising, and then all of a sudden they disappear. And then I just wonder, like, start looking at them online. I say, oh, this person's got a job, very stressed, taking all these hours. And it's like, dang, I wonder, you know. So I know we have a couple of programs here where they sponsor people, you know, and stuff like that. So, and I've been getting paying attention to a lot of people that have started in towns like yours. They'll try to take jiu-jitsu to, I guess, disadvantaged communities. So I like stuff like that. That's
I think. Well, and see, don't you think that's kind of sometimes a slippery slope? Like, I of course I'll never say the name, but if I have a couple students that are really promising, like tough kids. But like I think what my dad would say, like when I was running, you know, back in the day, he would say, okay, you're going to work your butt off. And if you don't work your butt off, you're going to get a job, right? You're going to bring some money to the table. You got to show me some work ethic.
Yeah.
I want to help a couple, you know, and I have helped, you know, again, pay for a tournament, pay for half a month, whatever I need to do. But I also think if you show the younger emerging athlete, like, hey, I want you to work, you know, because jiu-jitsu is a great thing. I'd love for you to, I wish everybody could be full-time jiu-jitsu students, 24/7, train every day. But also, I think if, like, for example, Marcelo Garcia had to take a train, you know, he had to sacrifice a lot.
Yeah.
You know, to be, so I think if you had to get a job in the morning, jiu-jitsu at night, and you got to grind, I think it makes the journey more rewarding, and I think to me it just makes you tougher.
Yeah, so
if I just gave a student 50 grand, I said, all your school's paid for, here's 50 grand, and you get to just train jiu-jitsu. I don't know if they understand how hard it is.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think that's somewhat how life works out as well. If you give somebody something, they don't know how hard it was to get it, so they don't have an appreciation factor for it. And versus if they're having to fight and grind it out, when they get it, they know they hold on to it because they worked so hard for it. You know?
Yeah, and they appreciate it. You know? Yeah. I mean, I think about, you know, in high school, this is not jiu-jitsu, but, you know, when I was running, it's like I ran 84 to 90 miles a week as a senior. You know, I ran 12 to 13 miles a day. I sacrificed, you know, I didn't go out. I, you know, my whole life was trying to get a scholarship, because my dad said, if you don't get a scholarship, I was going to work at Ford. I was going to work probably in the foundry. Not to say that that's a bad job, because I got tons of friends that have worked in the automotive for now 30 years, mm-hmm. 32, 33 years. So, but my dad would show me, if you work your butt off, you do the things and make as many smart choices as possible, and you show that grind, you're going to appreciate that grind. And to this day, that's just my motto. Like with my school, I just want to be there all the time because I want it to be the best. Now that's probably sometimes it's counter because I'm so high strung sometimes I can't turn it off, but I'd rather be this way than the other way.
So you were train 5 times a week or 6 times a week guy?
I don't know if training, but for my school, I want to be there for all my students all the time. Some days I just want to be there, so I'm watching them, right? And I want to help them. And if they come in and once somebody's in a down in the dumps, or I want to be that guy that kind of can make their day better. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily be at my school that I need to train all the time, but if I can say, hey man, hey Daryl, you just hit that arm, that's awesome. That right there could have made a difference in your day. Now, if I wasn't a hardworking professor and I was just like, hey, I put a name in Road Jiu-Jitsu up and then I start just collecting $100 and I only show up twice a week, I know some that are, they don't, I want to be there every time that we're open, 7:30 in the morning, 11:30, 6 p.m., the kids' class, even if I'm not teaching, I still want them to know that I'm a best. I think that's just the way I'm wired. And maybe, like I said, sometimes I do need to take a step back and kind of rest a little bit, but it's hard. It's just hard for me to rest because I never want to fail.
How has that attitude been one of the biggest ways you've been able to sustain your school for such a long period of time, you think?
It has to be. I think just like with my running, my business Run Safer. When I was a sales guy, I think anybody that wants to have a successful business or be successful in anything, I think you got to be a little bit obsessed, right? You got to be a little bit over the top. To me, I think when people used to call me crazy, or they call me Forrest Gump, or they call me whatever they wanted to call me, I think that's a compliment. Are they like, do you ever leave your school? No, because I like it. I like being there. I don't know. I don't think that's a bad thing, but I think that's just the way. If you see successful people, most successful people love what they do and they love being there and working their tail off and trying to learn. Never stop learning.
How did you guys manage to keep people interested or knowledgeable during like the COVID shutdowns and stuff?
I was pretty. I sent them videos after videos. I'd send them links of footage of matches. I stayed engaged pretty heavy with my students. They probably thought I was a little crazy, but I'm like, I don't care. Lindsay and I would do techniques together. I'd send them, closed guard armbar, closed guard kimura. The next day it'd be outside trip, inside trip. So I stayed engaged and told them I missed them, and they knew that I cared about them. So when we were able to open back up fully, they were like, man, coach never gave up. He never, he wasn't going to quit. Yeah. And I think that's what made them, as soon as they could come back in, they know I care about them. I'm just not trying to get the $100. That's what I mean. They know that I care about them.
It was pretty, pretty testy at times, because I would see a lot of businesses around here. A lot of the small ones, they just started to close left and right. And I knew when they were closing, they weren't going to open up again. And I started to think one day, I was like, what are all those small jiu-jitsu studios, going to do?
Yeah. But, I think that's, thinking about business, right? Think about jiu-jitsu business. And, I've been blessed and I'm fortunate. I worked my tail off. I saved my money. I had a kind of a plan of what I wanted to do. I planned ahead. So I always, and I had a great landlord, a good building. So I always paid like a year ahead. Yeah. So I always plan. I always, I hate to say it, but I always plan for a pandemic in a way. Mm-hmm. I always plan like, hey, there's some bad shit that could happen and I'm going to be ready for it.
Yeah.
And so like, I was already a year ahead on payments. I had a good relationship with my landlord. So that even before I signed the where I was going to have my school, I kind of prepared for that right hook. And the pandemic was more than a right hook.
Yeah.
It was a Mike Tyson uppercut to the jaw.
Yeah, it was.
But you gotta. You, to me, that would be my lesson to business owners too. It's like, I know, you know, it's sometimes things happen, but the more you're prepared and you're not overextended financially and you know you're ready, then you're going to last a lot longer than somebody that just jumps right into it not prepared.
Gotcha. That's good, because were you one of the first jiu-jitsu places in Monroe?
There was one in 2009, which is a purple belt, you know, one of the, you know, Monroe's so small. He owns like the insurance agent and the Mexican restaurant, and he's a purple belt. And, you know,
yeah, gotcha,
like,
gotcha.
Yeah, like if you came to my hometown and we walked, you'd be like JT Torres, when he came a couple years ago, he called me the mayor. He's like, how? You know everybody in this town. Like, number one, there's not that many people in the town, but it's kind of that type of. But Tino is a purple belt, and he had a little club in 2009. It wasn't really a school, but you know he got a lot of people started in Monroe in jiu-jitsu, and he had to stop because he's so busy. And so I would be the first official school in Monroe. You got Toledo, that's 20 miles south in Ohio. A lot of great schools there with Don Tenorio and Chris Blanke, and you know, a lot of just Deion Thompson, a lot of good schools there. And then you head up to Detroit with Detroit Jiu-Jitsu, and but I'm right in the middle of that, right? Mm-hmm. So the market was, you know, 160,000 in my county, 18,000 people in my little town. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me to have right now this month, I have about, including the kids, I have about 84 students. I'm happy. I'm super happy.
Nice. Yeah, that's good. Did you happen to catch the recent WNO championship?
Mm. I watched all of it. You know, Nogi Worlds is going on right now too. I got to get on the. As soon as we get off, I'll be watching all that too.
Yeah, Taylor's fighting in it. She's going to fight. She's leaving Thursday to go fight in it. So it's nice. I think it's her first. It has to be her first Nogi Worlds at black belt. So
awesome. The WNO, there was, man, these young kids. I mean, that's all I can say, right? It's like, you know, the Cole from, you know.
Yes, Cole Labate is good.
I mean, his game was so, you know, in the game, and then the Rotolo brother, it's like you're watching them and you're like, man, they're only 16, 18 years old. What's coming down the pipeline next? I mean, some of these kids are starting so young, and they have their wrestling, they have their judo, they have their jiu-jitsu, they're hybrid, right? They're,
mm-hmm.
they're really, and they love it, and they're obsessed with talent. You get that combination, it's like they're making Micah Musumeci look old.
Yeah.
And he's only 23, 24.
Yeah, and that's what is amazing. I if I had my wish, my dream match was going to be Musumeci versus the young kid, Labate. And I wanted to see that because I watched him. I was at the Pans when he was fighting. Every match he looked really great in. I actually think the hardest match to me he had was his first match against kid I know, Mikey. So only one that came close to scoring on him. But he's so he moves like he's been grappling like for years. I watch his face. He does not get bothered no matter what position you put him in. And the way he, when him and Gio Martinez went at it, that he looked like he was a high level black belt. And I was like, so when they're like, this kid's just a blue belt, I'm like, Jesus, that's almost like an age thing. You know, he doesn't have the time enough to be black belt.
Yeah. And see, and that's the thing too, man. This, you know, we could go out, I probably touched on this last time, the belt systems, but it's like, the kids, you know, competition-wise, he's a black belt. I mean, maybe, you know, when you think about curriculum and knowledge-wise and teaching, you know, there's two different belts, right? You have competition. He's a black belt. He's beating world champions.
Yeah.
But then you have the old guy like me that has the knowledge. Now, could I even come close to touching Cole? No, not even a chance. He's gonna tap me in probably, what, a minute? Probably. So, I mean, maybe I can hang in there with some snapping turtle stuff, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
But the knowledge to being able to teach is another different type of black belt.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. It's like somebody said, like, when do you get your next belt, coach? I'm like, when I'm 72. And they're like, what? I'm like, when I get a when I get a coral belt, it's 72 years old. You know, because I'm third degree, so then I've got another 3 years to my fourth, and then I have to wait. It's like 5577 or something. Wow. So I'll get my coral belt when I'm 72.
Damn, you were supposed to start this sport when you were 18.
Yeah. But it's, you know, that's the belt system. You know, back to the WNO, it's like you see these young kids. I mean, the Rotolo brothers are black belts in competition. Come on, those guys are monsters. They're so good you can't even explain it.
I saw the older one. So what is it, Ty? The younger one is Cade, right?
Well, you mean like within minutes, right?
Oh, they're twins.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Wow. I watch them roll against each other all the time on Flow, and they act like they were middle brothers. You know how the middle brother, he's too close to be your little brother, so they try to kill each other.
I'm about 99. I'm Google checking it right now because I don't want to say any. I'm about 99%. Yeah, they're. Let me see. I gotta do it right now. Rotolo.
Yeah, they had to go against each other in one of these tournaments, and they did.
Did you see him in the garage?
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Two twin brothers. Yeah, here we go. There it is. Yeah, two twins. Yeah. So actually, you said that. I'm like, yeah, the older one. I'm like, maybe by a couple minutes.
Gotcha. That's crazy. Some of my friends say I'm slow. I'm like, they're twins? I'm like, yeah, you've been staring at them the whole time. What was your, if you had to pick a best fight of the night, what was the match you enjoyed the most?
Rotolo catching Dante in that backwards guillotine entry. I tried to slow it down, like, I don't know how many times. I slow-mo'd it to see how he entered into that. And he got him with, 7 seconds to go?
Yeah, their entries are innovating.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, those type of entries are interesting because I like to slow-mo stuff down. My body type's never going to be like Rotolo Brothers, but then I look at like the basic scissor takedown that blew out that guy's knee, the Rotolo, remember? Mm-hmm. So that was, when people talk about how
that was a Cisneros.
Yes. So you think about like when people say, hey, why is the scissor takedown bad? It's like that you saw. That's why. His knee collapsed, right? I mean, it probably tore his, he still came back and fought, but that had to do something. Pretty good damage to his ACL.
And he's had some problems before, too. So it's really sad because Cisneros is very exciting to watch. He's very fast-paced. What was your, I guess, you, if you had your upset, like which match shocked you the most?
So, the heavyweight, and names I'm drawing a blank right now, but when...
Dirt Tate.
Yes, that was... And Gabby getting her back, and Gabby get me.
Look, I have flow, so I was in the comments trash talking.
you were hiding.
Because Gabby just doesn't, in the last two fights to me, she just doesn't seem like herself, And
I wonder if she's got an injury or battling something. I don't know.
Yeah, because she normally, instead of doing her like really, really heavy pressure passing, she's been playing open guard a lot, and it's like, why not do the stuff that got you to the dance or the biggest damn, one? And so I didn't know if she had an injury or what, because it really seemed like when she got the guard pass the first time, that was it. She seemed like she was already kind of gassed. And then I don't know if the other girl got in her head when she was trash talking her at the press conference,
why she... I either think injury or she, I don't know, because you're right. She's definitely not playing her typical game, her power game. You know who else impressed me is Mikey's sister, Tammy.
Yes. She looked great. And when she fought, the way she fought Barbosa was, I wish that one would have been in the finals, but I like Tammy looked good, especially taking so much time off. She definitely, I felt like she had the fire once Mikey lost, because she was going this is the only time I ever see the Barbossa girl actually look worried. And her, oh, yeah, her face was so heavily focused, and Tammy was attack, and I was like, but a lot of times, it's probably just a bias. I think the lighter weight men and the lightweight women sometimes are the best jujitsu to watch. They are doing things that are so technically, it's just very beautiful to watch. And then it's because they're not muscling each other, you see techniques working at the highest level.
Yeah. And you know, that another upset to me, or well, of course, not, you know, just me, everybody, was when Mikey got his guard passed. I mean, because that's unheard of. Like, just like Gordon Ryan, I mean, Gordon Ryan even said, it's like, you know, for that. But and Gordon was right. And, you know, again, Mikey Musumeci, one of the best of all time, amazing person. I've had him here for seminar. He's a hard worker, just a good jiu-jitsu representative, right? But when his guard was passed, it was almost like the air went completely out of his balloon. Mm-hmm. If you know, like, as soon as you see it, was like he's like, he was almost in disbelief. Like he had never done, and I'm sure he has, but it was like he had never really done many situational rounds with a lot of, with somebody on top of him in that position.
Yeah.
Because it probably just never happens.
Yeah. There was another guy that was like that. I saw, I forgot who it was, but this was, Ronaldo, Junior was passing, you know, they were saying this guy can get his guard passed, and once Ronaldo passed his guard once, he just started doing it over and over again, and they were like, he is putting on a clinic and guard pass. I was like, no, once you know, like, somebody gets past your A game, a lot of people, they haven't practiced for B and C, and it's right. It's crazy that even at the highest level, and I think it's just because it's very, I don't know, in your training, it's very hard to put yourself in those bad positions. It's just, especially when you get so good, you know, if you're smoking everybody in the room, it's like, well, there is no bad position for me, you know. I'd be, and so, and then I think he also was heavily focused on, like, trying to do those leg entries. He said he was working on his breaking mechanics and everything like that. So it's like that one little chink over here will totally.
And I'm forgetting the guy who the guy's name that passes that beat him with the North South choke, who beat Mikey. Do you remember his name?
I don't.
We should know because he's amazing.
Yeah, but he, like, was explosive.
He was, and what I was going to say is, like, that goes to show you at the highest level the strategy and the game plans, because he executed, and then the North South choke, you could tell he was working it and working it, and then finally got Mikey's chin to the ceiling, and it was over.
Yeah,
you know, but that
was impressive. But then I kept thinking, he can't be a scrub. There's a he's an announcer. His name's Shannon Sharp. He said, if you are in a professional sport, understand that any day somebody out there can make you look foolish. And he said, don't think that they got this jersey and, oh, you know, I'm better than, he said, nope. He said, whoever prepared better at any given day, another athlete will show you that they're supposed to be there. And so it was, and then I watched another fight where Mikey Musumeci went up against he went in the open division, but this time that year he went to a straight division. He went, and that black belt slaughtered him. Just put the pressure on, and then the announcer was saying he wanted to show Mikey he's not Muhammad Ali. If you come to this division, I'm not going to be nice to you.
That was the Europeans.
Yeah.
That was in Europeans. Yeah, and I watched that too. And same thing, right? He got his guard passed, got mounted.
Yeah.
And pressure.
Yeah. And so it was because, you know, when I saw the video queued up, I was like, oh, how is Mikey going to beat this heavyweight? And I was like, oh, he's not. And so I kept thinking that too when he was at 155. I was like, I wonder if gaining that much weight, because they said he weighed in at 51. So coming all the way from like 33 or 25 all the way to 55, if his gas tank, you know, was kind of on E2.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they say when you gas out, that's when you tap the stupid stuff. And if you got to gain 25 pounds, you know, for a fight, I'm not really sure if his body was, like, ready for, like, being that heavy, you know.
No. And Mikey, you know, yeah, I mean, and, you know, at the end of the day, the sport is – it's rapidly progressing. So you're getting these young kids that are blue belts, and they're it's not going to slow down. I mean, because jiu-jitsu is a growing sport. You're getting the talent pool's growing, athleticism growing, the wrestlers are coming in. You know, kids are starting at age 4. We're going to keep seeing more and more stars. The problem is, an older grappler, like I said, we can't keep up with the names. It's like, who's that guy? You know, you get, you like, this guy's the best. It's like, oh, this guy just beat that guy. What's that guy? There's so much talent, man. Whereas back in the old days, you had Marcel Garcia, you know, Saul Oliveira, Shaji, you know, you kind of could stick with the same crew for a while, Roger Grace, you know, and then Boucher. But it's like, now it's just rapid fire talent and hard work. And it's fun. That's the reason I love flow grappling too. It's like I could just.
Yeah,
I think these matches.
It was actually pretty funny when the WNO championships was coming. I queued everything up to watch it. My damn subscription expired that day, and I was like, "Shit, I have to sit here and pay this $143 because I know I want to see it."
Oh yeah,
I was like, they timed that so perfectly well.
Yeah,
but
say, you know what though? That's what I tell my students. I said, if you want a Christmas gift, if you want, a birthday, if you love grappling. It's worth the $143.
It really is, because not only that, I think I learn more sometimes. So I'll watch they have a thing on there called Fix My Game. So I love to go in there and look at those little, and I always feel like I'm learning something different to try it out. But then I also like that I could put that fighter's name in the block, and then I can watch, you know, them do it in competition. I say, you know, that's the practical way that he actually does it. So I think it's a great tool.
I'm gonna try to do that. So JT's flying in next Friday, and then I have Dean Lister coming in with Jeff Glover.
Nice.
In February. So I'm gonna steal the Fix My Game idea.
Yeah.
I'm gonna pay for a private lesson from JT on Friday. And do my own Fix My Game.
Nice.
And then, hopefully, Dean and them, I'm not for sure if they do privates, but if they do, I like to roll with Jeff and Dean and do Fix My Game with those guys. Mm-hmm. It is cool to roll hard with that level and then see what they feel, see what they see.
Yeah.
It's a cool concept. So I think flow grappling is doing a great job of creating good content, not just the competitions, even though WNO has really elevated that no-gi, but just the stuff that they're coming up with their podcast and their, you know, Hollywood and all that stuff. I think they're keeping people buying those subscriptions.
Yeah, that's for sure. Glued to the TV. They do some really good production, but I think that they do at least have their nose. You know, they sometimes with some of the girls, I was looking at the comments, they would say, well, you know, this person just got on the show because they're pretty, and this way, then they get them against somebody else and they get killed. And they say, that's the difference between being an Instagram, you know, whatever, and a jiu-jitsu practitioner. But I think that Flo does really good at picking matches that live up. The only match that I saw recently that was just bad was...
Can I say it before you say it?
Which one?
Josh Hinger.
That's it, man. I just knew it. Josh and Wagner. And I was just and I just was like, oh, it's going to be so much. These guys... And I kept thinking, like, are they afraid of the other ones guillotine so much that they're really not going to... And they just refused to commit. And I was just like, these are the guys that I send everybody to. I say, if you want to be mean, if you want to be aggressive, let's say you don't have a lot in the gas tank, this is Josh, you just outside single to a choke. And when I saw them, like, I was like, what the hell am I? What is this?
But
that
was the worst one. I think that's, you know, and you know what? They actually said it, I think, in the broadcast. Didn't they say, the worst match in the history of WNO?
Oh, wow. See, that's got to hurt. That's got to hurt.
I think they said that. Yeah, it was, I think Hollywood, is it Hollywood Mike?
Yeah, Hollywood Mike.
I think he may have said that, I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
But you know what, though? Bottom line is, though, it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Josh. I mean, those guys, great games, great, you know, you look up their highlights. Josh came here. He was here for, I've had a great instructor, great competitor, world champ. No, I mean, great chin strap, great hanger team. You know, it's just that match, just that matchup just wasn't, it was a bad matchup.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I think, like you said, they didn't want to take a chance.
Yeah, I kind of felt that way as well. Unfortunately, when I watched the finals and I got Mikel Galvão and the older Rolatolo, I was like, I thought it was the same thing. They had so much respect for the other one's ability to trap them that you could see they were high level grapplers, but they were not interested in making the first move. You know?
Yeah. See, that one was a tough one. Watching that one is like, I felt like, I think it was Cade, right?
Cade.
But I thought Cade should have won because it looked like he was trying to pass more than being swept. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, he was like, to me, he moved the whole, was that 30 minutes?
Yeah, they went the whole 30 minutes.
I mean, think about the movement that he had for 30 minutes. Yeah. I mean, you know, was it deep movement? I just know he was moving. But I think maybe his little fear was if he got a little bit too deep, then he's in the trap.
Because, what they had said, and I haven't been able to find a match, that these two have fought before at Purple Belt. It was either, and Cade made one mistake and ended up losing 11-2. And so he knew that if he just opened up a little bit, that Micah was going to counter. And I was kind of shocked too, because I never thought of him as a counter fighter. But it was like he had a game plan set. He was looking for some reaction, even when he kept feeding him his leg, and he would not. It was like once he would not go to any other game plan.
And do you think Micah thought that he was winning?
Yeah.
So then you look at that money. What is? Was it 30,000?
Yeah, it was big.
So I, you know, as a personal note, like when I would run, you know, there's races where you could win 30,000, or you know, some of the bigger races. There's prize money in track and field and road racing. So sometimes you did, like, there was races where should I went out really hard and chance like getting a big lead early, but then if I faded, you know, I could go from making a paycheck of 30K down to 10K off of one place. You know, like first place is 30, second place is 10. So maybe Mike was like, well, I'm up, I don't need to take a chance now. You know what I mean? And then Cade probably said, well, I'm up. I think that almost felt like that match.
Yeah, because I will say, like, when he was, you know, on his butt and he was doing his guard retention stuff, he looked like unbothered to where he didn't feel like he was concerned about anything. They had those spats of like movement in the very beginning where you were like, oh wow, you know, this could be extremely crazy. And then I was thinking, like, one of them's what, 18 and the other one's 17, or is it 19 and 17? So they're both, they had the ability to really like have like some fireworks, but I was just like, oh no, they have studied each other so much, they're like, nope, it's not gonna happen. Just like when he fought Johnny Tama in the first round, and I saw him get that choke on Johnny in that position, I was like, that is a no-gi world champion you just got. And it looked like they were flowing through some positions, and it just looked, he was very sharp. And I sponsor Johnny Tama. So I messaged him. I said, after seeing that match, I want to make a division for people with long arms, and I want height divisions as well. And I said, those boys' arms are so long. I watched the other one just reach and just
already. Was that the Darce?
Yeah, Darce, yeah. Right? He got him with the Darce.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And so, but it's not only that, they get that Darce anytime you stick your neck out. They grab
anywhere.
It. And then the other one, he's so tall, he'll just lean over and snatch double legs. You know, and I was like, I would hate to have to fight somebody.
And that's when you like see him do things like that. It's like, is that a perfect textbook double leg?
No,
it's just his body type and his athleticism and speed.
Yeah.
You know, like, would I want him to teach my students that double leg?
No,
but it's good for him.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was thinking when I look at some of it, that sometimes you can be very technical, and then in no gi, a plain old explosive person can somehow get through that at a certain weight. Like I think of Nicky Rodriguez, you know, when I think of like, he just showed up, and it was like, for a while, it just looked like he was just running across the mat, down to tap right. everybody. You know, and yeah. they would yeah. just be like, oh, my God, Nicky Rod. And I'm just like, it really just looks like a 260-pound guy sprinting. And
yeah.
you can't stop the sprint. And then they say, oh, that's a takedown. I'm like, yeah, it's something. But
yeah.
it works yeah. On, you know, people that big. But I don't think I would have ever bought an instructional from
yeah. Well, see, with Nicky Rod, too, it's like his gas tank, his knowledge of wrestling, and his and the jiu-jitsu technique catching up with him.
Yes.
He's hard to stop because he never stops.
Yeah, yeah. And that's it's like an anomaly. Also, I would have liked to have seen Nicky Rod and like Buchecha fight several times, you know.
Yeah.
Because Buchecha yeah. is somebody who's big and strong, who's also knows how to stop and then move when he's ready. I love watching his fights.
You know what's going to be a good one, I think, now that there's this little rivalry going on, is when Nicky Rod goes against Gordon Ryan.
That was going to be my next one, because I listened to the Nicky Rod interview where he basically says, in my opinion, Gordon could have always been fighting. Some people just can't take hard rooms. And I was yeah. like, yeah. I was like, oh, man, here we go. And he you know, I kind of thought, well, yeah, eventually they were going to have to fight. They were both heavyweights, you know.
Yeah.
There's only so long, you know, that the alpha's making that much money before they started to say, hey, you know, you could probably beat, you know, this person. So,
right.
And obviously because they roll together every day, they're probably familiar with the other one's game so much that they started to say, he likes to do this and I could probably do this and this, you know. So it would be exciting, but I do think in that one I would edge it out to Gordon, because I think he's just going to cancel out Nicky's takedowns. He's just going to sit
yeah.
and go right to the legs, which I don't think he's fought a leg fighter as experienced as Gordon Ryan yet. You know.
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to the time and duration of the training and health. But at the same time, who's in the room with you? You know what I mean? So, like, Gordon Ryan's trying to start a business. He's got his BJJ Fanatics. He's got his broadcasting. He's got his girlfriend. He's got his Instagram. He's got his Facebook. He's making that money. He's got his cars. He's got a lot mm-hmm. of stuff going on, right? Now, you get somebody that's super hungry that's I'm not saying it's Nicky Rod, but it possibly. And I'm not saying Gordon Ryan couldn't beat him, but, like, if the focus leaves a little bit too much mm-hmm. and you got the hungrier person that's pretty dang talented like Nicky Rod, that's where it becomes an interesting matchup, because you and I both know you are who you hang out with, right? So
yeah,
if you're training yeah. and you're grinding and you're the Rocky Balboa and you're going in there and you know this is it, this is my way to make it out of here, and this person's already made it, they can say they're hungry, but are they really that hungry when they've got all these distractions?
Yeah, that's
I don't
true.
Know. And I know that Gordon Ryan's one of the most talented grapplers of all time, right? But it's yeah. like you still take that. I always like that hungry person that is the underdog.
I think sometimes Gordon, so much, you know how he always says everybody sucks and blah, blah. I think because he actually internalizes and believes that it makes him sometimes appear to be lazy. Because he's like, oh, yeah. You know, these guys so suck and they stall me. So it's like that lack of respect thing. I think if he does lose, it's going to be somebody that surprises him, you know,
yeah.
that he's just like, oh, this guy's garbage and he's going to be playing. And the other person's going to be like, oh, no, I'm here today. You know,
yeah.
like that heavyweight final where, you know, that guy beat, you know, what was it? Kynan Durte. And
yeah.
and then he was just like, oh yeah, I train 2 days a week, and you know, blah blah blah, and
yeah,
you
know, yeah,
you could be, was, and I was like, wow. And then so I listened to him on a podcast today. He said my biggest thing is, he said, I always big up my opponents, and he said if everybody sucks, he's like, then who am I? Why am I proud of beating anybody?
Right.
And he was like, if yeah. everybody sucks and I'm the best, he was like, what am I really the best at? You know. And
that's what Gordon was saying?
No, that's what the guy that beat Keenan said.
Oh, okay.
He said, you can't brag about being the best fighter in the world and then say, oh, your competition sucks. Well, how good are you then? And so he was basically saying his whole thing is, when he was fighting, they had this whole thing where he would start to touch people and feel it. And he said he would hear them breathe. he think, oh my God, you know, I'm actually doing good against these people that were supposed to, you know, beat me. And as he got into deeper and deeper into the rounds, then he got more confidence. And he said even he would get somebody that was grab his leg, and he had been thinking like, oh, this guy's a leg guy. And when he get out, he said, wait a minute, you know, I'm supposed to be here. So he got more and more confidence as he went through each matches. So even when he was with Kynan, he said he heard him. He said he heard him say, and he was like, oh, you know, he didn't expect it. He thought it was going to be an easy match for him.
Yeah. And see that, and that's the thing, at that level, you got to go into every match like it's the final. You know, I mean, and this is, you know, a different level, but even some of the people that are going out to World Masters coming up, right? They'll say, hey, there's 73 people in my bracket. It's like, all that matters is the first fight. Because I don't care if there's 173 people in your bracket. If you lose the first fight, that's it. Mm-hmm. Then you're going back to the Bellagio and throwing some money away or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But every fight is the most important fight. And that's, you know, I always take it back to my running days. I used to think every dual meet was the most important race. Every league meet was the most important. Every regional meet, every state meet, every Midwest championship. That was the mentality I think I learned from my dad too. Like, every opportunity could be your last opportunity. Mm-hmm. So you better jump in there and leave an imprint on that opportunity.
Yeah, and I kind of think like that as well. I'm fighting in this current Masters Worlds in November. And then I think I'm going to start doing it every year with the pans. But I was telling people, like, I don't get nervous in any of my competitions because in my head, I'm practicing the skills on somebody I don't know. You know, it's literally, and a lot of times, even in the competitions, my hardest roles have come in the room. And it's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, my whole thing is now I get to test this stuff out in practicality with somebody who's doesn't even, you know, traveled around the world may not even be that great, but you know, they're there. And so I always think, I never think about the event. I just think about, he's grabbing, I want an underhook this. And I'm literally just thinking about the moves. I don't even know when the tournament's over till I hear.
Right. Well, and this is where I like, you know, the wrestling side of it, having the wrestling background, is when you smack hands, when you go to Worlds, as a wrestler with your jiu-jitsu, you've got that mentality, is you know when you smack hands, you're ready.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of jiu-jitsu people smack hands, and it's more – in a world, you can't do this, because I've seen a lot of people lose matches because they almost go into it like it's in the training room. You know, like the kind of the lazy roll or whatever, mm-hmm. But it's like, it's only, you better be like, as soon as you smack hands, because that takedown could be the match is over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, you know, you pull and you pull easy. He does a quick pass, almost pass. He gets the advantage, match over. So I think that's right when you smack hands, your focus needs to be, I'm ready to bring it.
Yeah.
And if you shoot, I'm going to sprawl and take your head through the floor. If I shoot, I'm going to drive you off through the score table.
Yeah, that's what I told the Gat wrestler last night. I said, my whole thing is, I said, I go back to the old Dan Gable principle. If you shoot, I score. If I shoot, you know, I'm still going to score too. So especially with the gi, I use the gi most of the time as the perfect wrestling setup, because I tie them up from moving. So when I initiate a takedown, it's like, oh, you're not going anywhere. I have all this material. And and then with me, I was trying to explain the concept of, because I came from wrestling to jiu-jitsu, my principle is, you may know three takedowns that your coach taught you, and you may be good at those, but for my entire life, I've been practicing counters. Right. And so it was like, I can either get suckered into wrestling you, or I can just do all the counters to the takedowns, because most coaches, that's what I was saying, but most coaches are offense driven. And so they're teaching the takedowns. They're not teaching, these are the 15 different ways a wrestler would probably get out of this. They're thinking about like the jiu-jitsu thing. So I know that that's what they're thinking. So I kind of do the opposite sometimes. So I was showing a guy last night, I will wizard people. So you know when you get a wizard, they'll hip into you hard. I said, I hip so hard that they think I want to do that. I said, and then when they go to the side, I lip arm out. And that's how I always get side control. Like, nope, I wasn't interested in a real wrestling battle.
Oh, so you do air guitar out?
Yeah.
Air guitar?
Yep. And then I was just like, but I wanted you to think, oh, he's a wrestler. He's going to go. It's like, no, I just wanted that reaction from you to think that I was going to wrestle you. It was like, I'm not interested in, like, I'm using my wrestling to do jujitsu, not to wrestle you. And and so it's actually kind of fascinating as far as a strategy, because I like to work everything from that takedown from side, and I operate everything from side control. If I feel like I'm in trouble, I'll go back to side and start back over. And I like a lot of gift wraps and arm locks, and so it's that's kind of what I'm going for when I go to the wars. I'm like, yep, my goal is to get to pass and get to side control, and then it's
But you know what? Speaking of back, like Josh Hinger, and thinking of like a great, you know, maximizing the wrestling with jiu-jitsu. What you talked about before in the gi, that outside, like the lapel drag outside single, how he connects. Yes. Like he would do a collar tie, no gi, to snap down to get the outside. But man, he's powerful with that lapel outside single, and then he goes right to your back. You know, like how he wrapped the leg up, like almost like Henzo showed this years ago, how he would twine the leg through once he would circle to the back. But like Josh taught a little bit of that here, and it's nothing like magical, but it's the timing of the snap down, like how quick he gets out to the side for that leg, you know. And most of the time he's snapping down to where he's not even getting a single. He's getting a straight snap down right to the forehead's hitting the mat. And then he's hitting the single as their knee hits the mat. So he's circling them back, you know, to take that. I think that's it. To me, like I wrestled when I was little, but like when I teach takedowns, I'm either doing lapel drag hard or snap down hard and get them moving around, you know, because takedowns at any high level competition, the takedown defense and takedowns is such an extreme important part. It's huge.
I got a somewhat competition based question, because you have students. How do you go about promoting your students who don't compete versus your students who do compete? Or is there a difference? And how do you say, hey, you need to compete once a year, or, you know, or once a belt level, you know, because I've seen schools do it different because they know people don't compete. And I've also seen to where, hey, if you don't compete, when you get your belt, they make you go through like a belt test with other fighters before you promote it. You know, how do you do that?
You know, so I'm going to give, like, you know, so it's tough, right? I think belt promotions as a professor, and I'm sure if you talk to 1,000 professors, they kind of have a different way that they promote their students. You know, so to me, I came up with this thing. If you compete, it's going to weigh, of course, to the positive, right? If you get out there and compete and I see you getting after it, that's going to help you accelerate faster, right? Because that probably means you're showing up more. You're coming to the open mats more because you're dedicated to compete. So that almost goes hand in hand that the person that competes, in my mind, are going to be promoted faster. But let's say if I had a student that doesn't want to compete, like I promoted two people to blue belt on Monday night, a 40 something young lady that has been with me over 2 years, right? She's taking it. She's a librarian, right? She's
nice.
Got kids. She's got family. She never thought she would ever start jiu-jitsu with her husband. And her husband started. He's a teacher at the same school that she's a librarian. So when they first started, I didn't know that, you know, they didn't think they were going to start. And the way they walked in, I was like, they're going to maybe last a month. Mm-hmm. Here they are over two years later. I could have them in front and they spar. They do situational training. She's had a black eye. She's had a knocked jaw. She's went through the, you know, did she dominate every sparring match? No. But if I had her show you mount escape, back mount escape, Americana, close guard for self-defense, you know, punch defense to clinch to takedown, punch defense to clinch to separation, you name it, somebody going into the pocket, somebody trying to hug her. Like, I could break it down where she is amazing. Now, could she go win a tournament? I don't know. But she doesn't want to compete. She earned her blue belt. You know, she's probably 300 classes in, 400 hours. Mm-hmm. That's a good blue belt. you know, now the one that's where the most, that's where I have to, as a professor, have to, you know, I write down my attendance. I watch all the time. I want to make sure that they understand the technique. If they choose to compete, that's going to, in my mind, it almost doubles their attendance in my mind. Like if they've got 150 classes, you start competing, in my mind, you're jumping that degree and you're jumping that belt level a little faster. Like I had a kid, he's 19, and you know, all state runner or state champion, 100 meter, 200 meter kid, tough football player, joined the school, got his blue belt in about, you know, seven and a half, 8 months. Cause he came every day. He competed. He was winning the tournaments. Just not just natural talent. He understood the technique. So he got his in 7 months. The librarian and the teacher got theirs in 2 years, you know, a little bit over 2 years, probably, you know, the competitor had less classes, yeah. But that's, you can see the difference to how the way I do it, you know? So, that takes a professor that cares, that's in there all the time, watching how their students prepare, come to class, how they treat people. They're not trying to hurt people. They're trying to help people. And that, I feel like I've got a good, my hands on the, my fingers are on the pulse.
Oh shit. So what do you do for, let's say, your guys that come in that are come from other grappling backgrounds? Like they'll come in as some guy that had 5 years of wrestling, or a guy that has a dang judo black belt already, you know, and you have to technically start them off as white belts when it's like, you know, in competitions, they're just gonna, you know, just
yeah. I mean, I've had a couple of those. You know, one, you know, definitely one of my students who wrestled for a long time, great double leg, great. Good double leg, great's a whole other word, right?
Yeah, yeah.
good double leg, and he was going to the local tournaments. You know, boom, takedown, double leg smash. You know, scrambling like in a white belt. If you got a scrambling wrestler, that they're going to win a majority of the local tournaments. I mean, they just don't stop, right? They're not going to get their back. They're just on top all the time, hammering. They're usually either going to win by a scarf hold, like some type of smash, not even a real submission, but just like so yep. much pressure, you know? So that guy, you know, I still go to, do you know jujitsu? You know, like he's going to accelerate faster, but I know that he's wrestled since he was a little kid. So he knows competition. He's going to do well at white belt. So I want him to know the fundamentals of five techniques from closed guard, sweeps, you know, some attacks from closed guard, side control escapes. I want to see how comfortable he is on his back. If he starts pulling on purpose because he's trying to get better on bottom, not just doing double legs, single legs, and dominating on top.
Mm-hmm.
And that this guy I'm talking about, about 2 months, 3 months in a row, he just kept pulling guard, and practicing what I was teaching. And then that, to me, he earned his blue belt. Now, if he would have kept doing double leg smashes and just, you know, fireman carries and just drilling people, then I probably would have kept him at the white for a while. But he started to understand jiu-jitsu.
See, it's actually pretty interesting. I like the jiu-jitsu portion of it more, even though I'm a wrestler, because it makes me feel like I'm thinking and I'm outthinking the person, and it's like a nice chess game going on. I actually only wrestle when I feel like, oh, I need to get some points on the board.
Right.
So I use my wrestling as almost like, all right, this is how I get an initial advantage. And then after that, I'm really open and I'm trying to learn some stuff. What about the, so you don't necessarily require that they compete, which is, I didn't know. I just assumed for a long time everybody competed till I started going to more tournaments. And, yeah. And so if you had to pick, what's your best run rule set, you know, even locally? I've been liking some of the EBI stuff.
If I had to pick, you know, I think we touched on this last time, right, with the competition rule sets. If I had to pick, I mean, I do like the, you know, sub only aggressiveness, no stalling, you know, I like that. I think if I had a tournament, which I still might try to do on a, you know, I'm looking for venues and stuff here locally. I like to just do a sub only 5 minutes. You get 5 minutes to sub. If you don't sub, you lose.
And you're out. And no gi, they've been talking about people greasing. So do you think they should go to making them wear the spats, the tights, and the long sleeve rash guards?
Oh, so their grease up too slick for any of the submissions?
Yeah.
And they'll
say, some of them will say, oh no, man, it's my hair gel. The hair gel is slipping down. Or, you know, they'll say somebody's legs are very lotioned up. So they're talking about, should they bring tights to no gi as well as long sleeve rash guards?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if people are greasing up, man, I understand the sweat because I'm a sweater. Like, you roll with me no gi, you're gonna be soaked. Uh-huh. That's the reason I don't like it. It's nasty. Like, most of the time, if I do no gi, I'm wearing my gi pants because I don't like that sweat all over the place. I don't want you to have sweat on you for me. And so, but if you're greasing up and they know you are, that's not, you shouldn't be doing that. Yeah, that's just not right. Because if I put baby oil all over me and then we smack hands up, it's not going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be nasty. but if that's what they have to do to equal that playing field.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. At the high level, they do all kinds of stuff. Do you think those, what do they call them now, PEDs give people that a real unfair advantage, like they say? You know,
coming from running, coming from the Olympics, I definitely think they do.
Okay.
I think when I finished 10th in the Olympic Games in 92, I'm not saying sour grapes. I finished 10th. I know I finished 10th. That's the highest I could possibly finish in Barcelona. But I do think there was certain individuals that were on EPO. They were on something, or, you know, blood doping. Because the rapid improvement, mm-hmm, is, you know, and it's just, you know, it's not normal, you know, especially if you're in it. Now, with jiu-jitsu, do I think it helps? 100%. If I started taking, Epicrit or synthetic red blood cell, and I can go all day long and I never get tired, 100%.
Yeah,
it's going to be an advantage.
I was,
I'm not even talking about the strength aspect of like a normal steroid, where not only can I, you know, double my strength, you know, I can go from my bench press from 245 to, let's say if I could take it to 330, 350 in a year, same weight. On top of doing steroids, you mix that with an Epicrit or an EPO. That means you're double the strength and you can go all day. I mean, can you imagine, like, if you smacked hands, you never got tired?
Yeah, that would be awesome. Jeez, because I
and so that's when people say, no, man, it's about the technique. It's like, but it is. But if you and I are the same, and I'm a cheater, and I take the PEDs, we're not the same anymore.
Mm.
You know, because that means I'm going to put the pressure on you, and you're like, this guy's going to slow down. I never slow down. I just keep coming at you. Then I jump off the mat. 2 minutes later, I'm ready to go again, and I'm never tired. That's where I'm like, that's where you can't, it helps.
Yeah, see.
And it's not fair. It's not fair.
And I was having this little debate because, you know, my two professors, the younger ones, you know, the Taylor will say, everybody's on PEDs, get over it. Everybody's on it. And she'll just say, name me one of these fighters that isn't on steroids. And so we would play this little game and we would just be like, man, they all kind of look like they're on something. And so, but then the other professor, Samson, the one who's the MMA fighter, he actually fought one of these steroid guys, and the guy did something crazy and hurt his back. So he's always had this back, you know, pain, and so he hates it. He said he's a cheater. And I was shocked when the Tiny Meow brothers popped, you know, years ago. And I was like, that's when I was like, it must, because I didn't understand why people did it. It's like, it doesn't seem to help you in wrestling, you know, so why would it help you in jiu-jitsu? And, you know, because I'm thinking, are they trying to just muscle out of submissions? And then when I saw the meows, you know, that was like, okay, there must be some advantage if an athlete, a smaller athlete like them, what are they like?
Well, see, and there's so many, you know, again, coming from the Olympic side and hearing everything over 13 years in the sport and seeing the sport change from even from the Ben Johnson days of the 980, 400 meter and 979. And then hearing just the gossip about it, right? It's not necessarily, you know, what the drugs are doing. It's also think about all the things outside of just the day of competition. It could be, okay, if I take this drug, then I can train extremely hard 7 days a week. If I'm natural, I've got to have my recovery days or I'm going to break down.
Yes.
So if you're on tea or if you're on some type of synthetic, then you're going to be able to train extremely hard and build double the muscle.
Yeah.
On top of, and you've probably never thought about the synthetic, you know, doping. So meaning you might look at me and say, no way, he's cheating. But if I'm taking a synthetic, like Epocrit or an EPO, you don't see me looking bigger, but my gas tank is tripled now.
Yeah.
So that means I can go, cause how many times you roll with somebody and say, dang, that guy went all now double that. That's the reason it's an advantage. Mm. You know, number one, being able to train every single day at the highest level and never get tired, never get injured. And then number two, if they are cocktailing that drug like a Lance Armstrong, then you're looking at steroids, Epocrit, a cocktail that's turning you into a robot.
Yeah.
And it's hard to fight a robot.
Yeah, and I was thinking about it a lot because a lot of the other guys, you know, like the Tiff Planet guys, will come right out and say, oh yeah, you know, I microdosed mushrooms before, you know, the matches, and I'll just be thinking like, now technically if the whole point you're doing that is because you don't get the normal anxiety that's supposed to come with the competition, can that be seen as, you know, kind of cheating too? And then that's what's so strange about jiu-jitsu. We really don't have a real federation that regulates, you know, like where you sign those more, you know, those moral statements, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this, can't take that. It's really just kind of like the Wild Wild West, you know?
Yeah. And that's a good point that you talked about, like mushrooms or marijuana or, you know, I think back in my career, like I would have, you know, I would be in a lot of pain. I was running 105, 120, 100. I got up to about 140 miles a week, right? At a high level. So I'm running almost 20 miles a day. It's sub six pace and, you know, 6 minute pace was my slow days, my recovery days, right? And then I would kill myself on my hard days, which would be Monday, Wednesday, Saturday. And then my Sunday was my long run, 15 to 20 miles on Sundays. So I gobbled up Aleve. I gobbled up Tylenol. Mm-hmm. I gobbled up, you know, to a certain time, you know, is that cheating? Taking Tylenol? Because I had to mask the pain so I could fight through to the next day, so I could get to the next week, so I could get to the next month, so I could go to that race and win 30,000, or I could get to the Olympic trials. So, or how about me drinking coffee and get, you know, the morning of the race, getting pumped up and maybe drinking, instead of one cup, drinking six cups.
Mm.
Is that, so what's the, you know, that's the slippery slope of like, what's cheating, what's not cheating, you know.
Like everybody's trying to get that advantage, but, and I was thinking about it only, you know, in the sense when I heard the, what is that guy's name? I want to say, it's not Gio Martinez, Roberto Jimenez.
Yeah.
He was one of the first ones that he said, oh yeah, you know, I like to, and he was talking to him in this whole rant about marijuana and how he respects the plant. And it was kind of funny to watch. I said, is this guy high right now in the interview? But, and then, so when I started to hear more fighters say it openly, I was just like, I was like, one, I'm kind of worried about because of how social it is. To start having these little kids think, oh, you want to be good at jiu-jitsu, talk trash, do PEDs, and take mushrooms. Like, you know, but that's kind of where it's like, yeah, it's that where I don't like flow sometimes, where it's like, oh, they guys, they can be very sensational. And so these guys will, they'll put a mic in front of them and they're like, how did you get ready for this match? So, yeah, I had to do some crack, you know, before the match. I did acid. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, you got to do acid. It's like, whoa, you know, there's really no, you know, like,
yeah, I mean, when you see, because kids are watching high level athletes, right? It's like, well, that person smokes a lot of weed in the parking lot before he comes in to train, right? His eyes are blown out,
yeah.
But yet he's still one of the top guys, you know. I don't know. I mean, that's
do you think you think that that lack of, I guess, seriousness around those types of issues is what makes it harder for jiu-jitsu to be held on the level of like judo, to where judo has an actual federation. You know, there's a whole Olympic judo committee. Judo is in the Olympics, you know.
Right.
And in order for jiu-jitsu to get to that, they kind of have to slice off some of that, to where they have to, you know, become like a respectable sport. Whereas now it's like,
yeah, I mean, that's a tough one, because I mean, jiu-jitsu is jiu-jitsu, right? It's kind of, and you know, you have your wrestling in the Olympics, you have judo in the Olympics. So it's going to be tough for jiu-jitsu to ever hit the Olympics. Yeah. I mean, cause you know, they wanted to cancel wrestling.
Oh yeah. I remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're trying to cancel the first sport, I believe the marathon and wrestling is kind of the,
yeah, the two
beginning
Olympics,
of rest,
yeah.
The beginning of the Olympics. Right. So you're trying to pull that out of the games. Yeah. It's like, I mean, it's like, you know, so I don't know how jiu-jitsu could ever get to the games, but I think as far as respect goes, I mean, I think you just have to have a good leader that, you know, somebody like a JT Torres. I mean, to me, JT is the perfect spokesperson for jiu-jitsu. Like, he doesn't talk trash. And I'm not saying talking trash. Some people, that's their thing, right? You know, that gets money in the sport, right? So that's a slippery slope, right? Do you want the kind of the super nice guy that just shows up, shakes your hand, bows, kicks some butt, shakes your hand like Barry Sanders, walks out, and everybody's like, you know, or do you want the guy going, yeah, you know, here we go, you know, in your face, you know, I just snap that arm up, and just, you suck, you know?
Yeah.
Who's going to tune in more? Who do kids today tune in more?
It's funny, because I think I have, like the both. Like, if somebody's heavy talking trash, it's like, I like to see them back it up, but I also really want to see them lose.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
it's tough, right? Because, you know, like, again, to me, like, having a lot of great people here for seminars is like, JT's just, you know, and Bernardo Fria, he's the same type of person. You know, he just go out, do your job, do it well, world champion, you know, and go back home, keep training hard, keep being a good example, you know, pretty much, you know, I don't know everything about their life, but staying out of trouble,
yeah,
and influencing people in a positive way, that is like that's how you're taken. To me, that's how I would want my kid to be influenced by jiu-jitsu, right? You know, I don't want them to walk around going, hey, you suck, and you suck, and you suck.
Yeah,
I don't like that.
It's one of those things where the way that you present jiu-jitsu to people as a self-defense and as a martial arts sometimes conflicts with the people that are promoted as the face. So when you think about your traditional martial arts, what they all at least pretend to be, they're extremely humble. You know, and you wouldn't know, you know, and then when
who would you like? It's you speaking of a face, like, you know how, like, you know, the NBA logo, right? Was Jerry West to me? You know, the so if I had to pick a face for jiu-jitsu, like in the last 21 years, I'm going with like a Hodger Gracie. Going with probably a Hodger Gracie, right? It, like, for me personally, like, he doesn't talk smack. He's good in the gi and he's good in he's great in the gi and he's great in no gi. Great ambassador. I think that would be the monument.
Yeah.
For jiu-jitsu. Marcelo Garcia would be in there too.
I like Hodger Gracie. I've heard really good things about Marcelo from Jamie Kilstein. That's where he started off at. And so Jamie always talks everything really good about him. And I like John Jock Machado. He seems like he's so humble and
100%.
I like his one of the other brothers, the bigger one, Regan. I like his stuff too, even though he's a bit more, you know, Hollywood. But I love his stuff. I went back and watched his classic match between him and Henzo, and then he talked about, you know, he was analyzing their fight, which was, you know, he went right in and threw Enzo on his head.
Yeah.
No, Hickson. Yeah. It was Hickson. He threw Hickson right on his head. And that he was giving him a hell of a match the first, like, 5-10 minutes. And then he said he saw that as the match went on, Hickson got stronger and stronger and stronger. And he said it was because he said he felt like he was so upset that he had to fight somebody he respected. He just wanted to get it over with. So he went out there with all his aggression. And Hickson just weathered the storm. Was like, yeah, I already knew he was going to come in and be super strong. So I like him because even though he was, you know, at the top for a while, he seems like he's very humble. And then, like, new school, I like the Pedigo submission guys, the Daisy Fresh guys.
Yeah.
I like Wiltsy. I like the Hillbilly Hammer, Jacob Crouch. You know,
I'm trying to work on those guys to do their camp here. So I've got Dean and Jeff coming in February, and then I'm working on like a April May training camp here because they do the 3-day training camps. Mm-hmm. You know, did you hear about that?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get because I respect those guys work hard. Again, hard workers. Yeah.
I saw them at the pans too. They're real down to earth, very approachable. Like, it was almost like it was kind of funny because I saw them like, oh my god, and I felt like they were celebrities, but I was like, oh, they're just kids from Mount Vernon, you know, living in a laundromat.
And that's what Flow Grappling does, right? Flow Grappling has created this platform to turn, you know, like the Hillbilly Hammer, right? Is that what they call the Hillbilly Hammer?
Yeah, Jacob Crouch, Hillbilly Hammer.
Yeah, so they're turning him. Like, think about it, man. With Flow Grappling, they've kind of made him a personality on social media, on his Instagram. And, you know, and he's a hardworking kid. It's great to see. You know, did you see what he did when he won that match?
Yeah, he broke down and started crying. Yeah.
And he gave it $1,000 back, though. Did you see that?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
So, you know how he got the submission? Because the guy that beat him got injured, so they put him back in. Did you know that?
Yeah.
So after he submitted, he was emotional. Right after, he's still kind of crying. He goes, look, I only made it here because he defaulted because of injury. He goes, I'm giving my bonus, my $1,000 to him because I feel like he gave me the chance.
Yeah.
To show.
I didn't know that.
I was like,
he gave
the $1,000 submission bonus back to that guy.
And they had a good match too, but that's just some really good character right there. See, so I think those guys, when I think of like who I would like the face to be, I think of people like that. And then the other part of me knows, but it's almost unavoidable. You're going to get the other personalities too.
Well, that's the way you kind of grow a sport, right? Like, you know, when you think about even like think about track and field, like everybody's like, man, track and field is dead. How do you promote track and field? You got to get these bad boys or these bad girls that are doing the 100 meter, and like as they're coming across the line, like Bolt was a name, right? He could come across the line. He's like, boom, run up in the stands, and you got to have some charisma to be able to draw interest of sponsors, and you know, and it's that fine line of charisma or being an ass.
Yeah.
It's like that. It's right on that line, you know. And you're almost going to be an ass, but you're not an ass.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing that's hard to like. There's a different type of like athlete cockiness versus like, okay, now you're just it's like right there on that line. It's I do find it interesting, you know, sometimes, especially when I see the matchups, when I'm like, the Tackett boys too, you know, very just humble, but can go right out there and fight, you know.
Don't you think a lot of the wrestler backgrounds, though, they've wrestled, you know, the wrestler has went through so many battles that it's hard for them to be anything but stoic.
Yeah. And
right? They're just like,
and I think it's the drilling. The way wrestling, even the drilling, is nonstop, just boom, 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 to where jiu-jitsu is not necessarily like that. Your instructor, you have that calisthenics period in the beginning, and then they'll teach your, you know, teach the technique, break, and you drill it for a few moments. That, you know, the other guy drills it a few times, they'll stop, come back, teach another technique, you drill that. You do that about 4 times, then it's like, all right, now you roll for 20 minutes. And it's like, well, a wrestling practice is really just your coach is going to show you one technique, and then he's basically like, go, and you guys are basically doing King of the Mountain. So by the time a wrestler transitions to jiu-jitsu, it's kind of like, oh, well, jiu-jitsu's tournaments seem like they're poorly run. You know, there's not every wrestling tournament you go to, there's at least 16 people in the bracket. It's double elimination. You know, it's Friday, you lose, you got to come back Saturday. You know, so you kind of have this thing. You're so used to being in arenas and jumping from mat to mat, your regulation 45-minute break time. So if you wrestle from middle school to high school and then you walk into these tournaments, especially a lot of the local ones, you're underwhelmed. You're like, wait a minute.
Oh, yeah.
It's even IBJJF, you'll think this is going to be the such and such. You get there and nobody's in there. It's just the people fighting. So it's kind of like why I say sometimes the hardest fighter in the room, because it's like, oh, I'm fighting a guy when nobody's looking. So I can kind of open up and do whatever I want to do.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes those tournaments, the local tournaments, all you hear is the lights sound like, there's just nobody there. But and like you said, some of those tournaments can go all day.
Grappling Industries. Oh, my God. One time in the Grappling Industries, I had so many matches, I just left. I literally just got tired of rolling. I think it was like match 8. I was like, all right, I am exhausted. I want a steak. I gotta get a
fight. Yeah, you gotta get out. Coaching too. Like when you're coaching, you know, it seems like I'm always the coach that has the last guy where they're rolling up the mats.
Uh-huh.
And they're putting the tables in the closet. There's one. I'm like, it's like 7:30 or 8 at night. My eyes are bloodshot. I got my face is blown out red. I don't have a voice left, and I'm always the last guy. But but that's the reason I do it, because I'm not gonna leave until my last guy's done either.
What do you got coming up there?
So at Monroe Jiu-Jitsu, we have JT Torres is coming on flying on Friday. He's got the seminar on Saturday the 16th. And then in February, Dean Lister and Jeff Glover's coming for, they're both actually going to teach both days. So Dean will teach an hour of gi, and then Glover will teach an hour of gi. They're going to use each other, you know, to teach. Then Sunday they'll come back and do no gi, Dean first, then Jeff second. And then I'm going to be working on some, you know, like I said, I'd love to get the Daisy Fresh crew here for the 3-day training camp in April, because I like to skip a month so I can promote and give some space for the cost. And then my ultimate goal would get a hold of, my friend Marcelo Garcia. I'd love to get him at my home school here and try to get my local gym, because my school's not big enough, and just really have a big, big Marcelo turnout if possible in the middle of 2022, which would be great.
Nice.
Outside of that, just teaching my butt off and loving jiu-jitsu every single day.
That's so you sent me a picture the other day, and I kind of want you to describe it and say like why that picture and the you know, teaching jiu-jitsu is so important to you, you know?
Oh, the picture with myself and Cole, in front of the garage in front of my school.
Yeah.
So that picture was, I thought I was going to have more people show up in my class. And you know, all jiu-jitsu school owners and professors have that day, like, hey, I'm gonna probably have 12 or 15 show up. Well, it was just one kid that showed up. So I was sitting there, and you know, and I treat, if it's one person or if it's 100 people, I'm gonna treat that class like it's the most important class of my life, because that person's coming in wanting to learn jiu-jitsu superpowers, I call it, right? They want to learn a superpower that day. Cole is 12, 13 years old. Love the kid. One of my favorite students. His brother, Caden, is a great student too. He's 19. But we're just sitting there having a talk, you know, and Lindsay took the picture. And it's like, when I walked out, I said, that's the reason I do jiu-jitsu, because this kid showed up and he was the only one there. I rolled with him. I showed him some technique. And, you know, he sends me a message on Instagram. He goes, greatest coach ever.
Oh.
And, you know, that right there, and I sent him that picture, and I, you know, I said, you know, blessed, you know, I just said, and I sent his mom the picture, and I said, you know, this is what it's all about. And it really is, because, you know, we can look at the WNOs, we can look at all, and we talk about these great, great people in these seminars, but at the end of the day, individuals like Cole, that it's 12 and 13 years old, or they're coming into that school, and you're making a positive impact in their life, where they're gonna have those memories forever. And that's to me what that picture is all about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to blow that up and put it in my school, because it's true. It's just him and I on the mat. The windows are foggy. it's sweaty, and it's, you know, the mats are sweaty right there where we're at, and that means hard work. And he's looking into my eyes, waiting for that next piece of knowledge that he can put into his game at 13 years old.
Nice.
You can't beat that.
Yeah, it was perfect. I saw the picture, and it reminded me of how I used to feel when I used to coach wrestling. And I was just like, yeah, you know, sometimes you get these moments where you know. It's almost like, I guess, how a teacher feels when somebody's getting it. And you're thinking, like, oh, wow, you know, that's the spark right there. And I'm always fascinated to see where they're going to take it, you know, how far they're going to go with it, because you never really know.
Never know.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think we covered it good. I just can't keep watching the Flow Grappling, the WNO, see this talent that's coming down the pipeline, and then good luck at your Worlds. That's going to be here before you know it.
Oh, yeah. So, this Friday, it'll be 30 days out. So I've been training and getting – well, I actually have a personal trainer who actually plays for the XFL. So I've been kind of getting myself – I've had him for the last 6 months. So I was like, if I want to show up, I'm definitely going to, you know – try to make sure I bring my A game. And then at the same time, it's just kind of exciting. This is going to be my first time ever doing any IBJJF competitions. I never did them because I just thought they were boring.
So you had to get your card. Yep. You had to get your registration.
All that. So
yeah, you'll have a blast. I've been out. I competed at Worlds out there twice, 2016 and 17. I mean, it's run well. It's like, you'll have fun. You'll have fun. The big key, like I said, the big key is you got your wrestling and you smack hands.
Bring
the heat.
Yeah, I saw there was a lot of damn Gracie Barhart guys. They were all over the pans. I was like, geez, that team is huge.
Yeah, they got a big team.
Yeah, it must be a decently run program because they were everywhere.
Yeah, I watch. It's fun. It's a good spot. And watch. What I like to do is you could go there and just watch jiu-jitsu. You could almost get overwhelmed because there's so much jiu-jitsu. It's Masters 1, Masters 2, Masters. You know, there's so much jiu-jitsu to watch.
It really was. When I went to the pans, some of the matches, some of the black belt matches, like the high level guys that were always on TV, actually were really boring to me. But getting to see the everyday local just show up and fight black belts, it was really inspiring, because those guys, they opened up. They didn't, there's a black belt here. I got an academy by the name of Diego Bispup. He went out and fought. Gustavo Machado was fighting, you know, and I've never seen him fight, so that was good to see. Gordo was there. Taylor made her black belt debut, well, her pin, her IBJJF. So it was, I was like, wow, it's actually interesting to see people you see just teach all the time, actually practically. So like, oh yeah, I can beat up my students and, you know, other people as well.
Fun. It's fun, man. And that's the thing. This journey that we're on is hopefully, you know, it's never going to end. We just keep learning. We keep meeting new people. We keep having fun. We keep working hard and keep doing what we do.
My last question is, when you have your students who you see kind of falling off the path, what do you tell them their goal should be to encourage them to stay in jiu-jitsu? Like, I know, so we do small things. Like, I'll tell somebody, hey, man, I saw this was getting a little better. You know, you got really good at not doing that. So how do you keep somebody centered and focused on the sport from white belt to black belt?
You just hit it right in the head. I think the positive reinforcement, checking up on them. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I had a student, he's on the verge of purple belt. I think he was getting discouraged because he didn't get the purple belt. I'm not for sure I'm talking on his behalf, but I haven't seen him since September 6th. So text him, call him. And then, you know, I'm following up like, hey, man, your game is getting better. I'm seeing technically these things, you know. And then today we hit base today. And I said, look, and he says, you know, coach, I'm tired. I'm, you know, a little worn out. But I think he was on the verge of never coming. If I never made contact with him and gave him that positive reinforcement to tell him, and I wasn't making it up because he is improved, but jiu-jitsu is hard, right? And I don't want you to get a purple belt underneath me unless you know you earn that purple belt. I'm just not going to give you this. You know, and now he knows, and I think that could have made the difference right there. Mm-hmm. So you as a coach, me as a coach, I think constructive criticism in a positive way is important. But I also think, you know, being positive with people. We are doing this as a hobby. Most of us are doing this as a hobby.
Yeah.
They don't need somebody else in their life ripping on them and saying, you suck. what they need is, hey, this is how you get better. Yeah, you may have messed up that time, but this is what you're going to do for that not to happen again, or we're going to cut this out to make it not happen as much. You know, instead of saying you suck, that's the way you can tell somebody without jumping on and getting down their throat. Because, and again, I told somebody this morning, I was like, everybody that walks through this door should be so happy, and they should be running through this door because they don't want to be late. They should never be on that parking lot going, or at home going, I don't want to do jiu-jitsu. That's, you know, and then my goal is I want them to be, never want to leave. I want them to go, hey coach, can we get one more round in? Or hey coach, what about this? Or hey coach, that's what I want to do for those students that might want to throw it in the towel. I'm like, I want them to not have that thought at all. I want them to be like, hey, I joined Monroe Jiu-Jitsu. This is a cool place to learn. I'm getting stronger, mentally I'm getting healthier because I'm in a positive environment with positive people. And then they just keep coming. And most of the time it's worked out like that. It's not, you know, I've had some people that have quit, but I think I have a good environment where people want to be on the mat.
Yeah. I got one. Last time I gave you three, so this time I'll give you five. What five grapplers are you looking out for now?
Five grapplers I'm looking out for. Now, JT Torres is returning, right, because he hasn't competed since pre-pandemic, right? So he's mm-hmm. going to come back on the mat. Plus, he's coming here, so I had to throw that out there because I like JT. And again, he's on it. He would be one of the top people that I would pick as a great ambassador of our sport.
JT Torres.
So JT, again, I said this last time, both of Rotolo's unbelievable, amazing jiu-jitsu that's crazy to watch. And entries, again, I like watching guys with creative ways they do things that's never been done before. And I think they're doing that. So that would take me to three. The return of Gordon Ryan in the exhibition in a couple weeks. And I want to see where that goes. And then the fifth would be, I'm excited to see Tammy Musumeci, like what she's doing next on the women's side, because she impressed me with how she looked, and she hasn't competed in a while. Wherever she competes next, I want to watch. So that's five.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you for coming on.
Anytime you want to talk about any topics, and we can keep it longer, we can go shorter. I love talking jits. Good luck at Worlds.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Yo, yeah.
Be first.
I mean, be first.
That doesn't mean first place. That means when you smack hands, be first.
So it was, of course, great, guys, having Professor Todd Williams back on the show. I purposely did not give him a long introduction this time, just because I want Todd to be a reoccurring guest on the show for our jiu-jitsu community. Not just that, I think he's a very positive, great ambassador for the sport, even though he does never he never says himself when I say stuff about being an ambassador. But anyway, so just at the end to say what I would not say in the beginning is Todd Williams is the Monroe Jiu-Jitsu founder and in Michigan. He's a Michigan native that has his name through distance running and was a state champion, All-American. Himself at Monroe High School in 1987 before moving on to greater things. He made two United States Olympic teams in 1992, Barcelona, and 1996, Atlanta. After retiring from professional distance running in 2002, he immediately started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and self-defense. Now, after 6,000 hours and 8 years of hard work, he received his black belt certification in self-defense from legendary coral belt Luis Polaris, January 22nd, 2021. So he's done great things, like created the RunSafer.com program, which has begun to teach runners and joggers how to be safer while exercising and conducting. He's conducted over 500 safety workshops in 35 states as well as instructing students in my actual hometown of Jacksonville, Florida, at the Lewis Polaris Academy. He also has had the opportunity to instruct law enforcement as well as National Guard men. And Todd has trained and learned from some of the best people in the world, including Marcelo Garcia, Bernardo Freire, Wellington Megton Diaz, and Andre Galvao, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's very humbling to speak to somebody who has been, who I see as, he doesn't see himself as a high-level jiu-jitsu athlete, but I see him as a high-level human being, one who is a high-level athlete his entire life and who is now taking the principles that he had, that was instilled into him, that he still has deep inside of himself, and is passing it on to other students. And I would like to see that more celebrated throughout jiu-jitsu versus some of the more controversial things that we can be known for. So, and Todd is working on a book. When the book does come out, I'm going to have him on the show to discuss and promote the book and the ideas, etc. We're going to push Todd to keep working on that book, and we'll keep abreast with everything that is going on in Monroe Jiu-Jitsu. That is about it. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can go to www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcLean Show and get a membership at the Patreon for as little as, I think, $1 to $3 a month. And with that money, I support other bigger independent media sources. I sponsor some fighters. I buy equipment for the show. This show is 100% made possible by the patrons. And that is practically it. So take a hand clap for you guys for keeping me able to do this and talk to great people like Todd. Thank you for tuning in, and see you on the next episode of the Darrell McLean Show. I'm sorry.